In Kendra Smith Howard's new book, Pure and Modern Milk, she tells the history of a nearly universal consumer product and sheds light on America's food industry. She notes that milk reaches supermarkets in an entirely different state than it had at its creation. She examines the cultural, political, and social context, discussing the attempts to reform the production and distribution of this once perilous product in the Progressive Era, the history of butter between the World Wars, the Butter Wars, dairy waste in mid-century, and the post-war landscape of mass production. She asks very important questions of how milk could be conceptualized as a natural product, and eventually we end up with Cheese Whiz. It is a fascinating book. Again, it's called Pure and Modern Milk and Environmental History Since 1900. Kendra Smith Howard is Assistant Professor of History at the University at Albany. And it's a pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
A delight to have you with us. An environmental history since 1900. Why start there? What is significant about that date?
Well, there's a couple things that happened right at the turn of the 20th century that are important. One is a lot of women shifted from breastfeeding to using other kinds of foods for their young children, and cow's milk was an important one. Another is urbanization. More and more people were living further from where their food supply came from. And there was also a lot more knowledge about vectors of disease. And so with germ theory and more increasing identification of particular bacteriological hazards, the milk supply became of interest to pure foods reformers and health officials.
And when it becomes of more interest, the interest is how do we keep it in supply, and how do we keep it safe, right?
That's right. Food safety is really critical. This is a time before widespread refrigeration, so ice is the way in which milk is keeping cool. It's traveling longer distances. And so as a result, there's more concern about especially milk in the summertime, when you see the number of infants that are at least suffering digestive distresses and sometimes even dying from a disease they called summer complaint during the summer months when milk was spoiled. So because of those concerns, health officials are worried. They're being pushed in part by parents to do more to ensure the safety of the milk supply. And so they start to take action, pushed by some of these citizen organizations as well.
So explain to me the two key words here, pasteurization and homogenization.
Sure.
I get pasteurization, mm-hmm. and of course Louis Pasteur and working with this to take out bacteria. I understand that. That seems fine to me. I've never quite, although you explain it, but I've never quite gotten a full grasp of what we're doing with homogenization.
Oh, it's just mixing the milk so that the cream no longer rises to the top, but rather so that
why do we want to do that?
Great question. I know that actually one of the main concerns that people had about pasteurization was that there was a less defined cream line. And so people at the turn of the century said, boy, that's problematic. Why homogenization? More, you know, this is something that I don't talk about in great detail because I was more concerned about hazards and purity of milk and less so about standardization. But I think it's probably about standardization of a product so that just as manufactured foods more generally reached market in particular kinds of ways. Post-war, the increasing concern about milk fats made wanting to have a uniform product that was lower fat more of interest. But I'd have to go back to some of the medical literature to see what kinds of claims they were making about homogenized milk.
But looking at pure and modern milk, we're basically then taking the product and screwing around with it, right? I mean, we have the homogenization, and then we're taking out milk fat. We have 1%, 2%, all these different varieties of milk now. So what we know of as milk is very different than what we knew about a century ago as milk.
Yeah, that's very true. And so also have our concerns about what pure milk counts, what we're concerned about, and what we laud has changed pretty dramatically as well. And that's also one of the things I want to pick up on. At the turn of the 20th century, some of the biggest concerns were natural hazards. But today, when we think of what we want, when we want pure foods, it's natural food that is free of technological contaminants, free of things like pesticide residues or antibiotic residues.
Right.
And so our very conception about what is pure and healthy and what are the biggest hazards has pretty radically changed over the course of the 20th century. And so that's part of what my history tries to get at.
So how much of it do you think we have right?
You know, as a historian, I guess I see my role as more in explaining how and why we've come to the system that we have. What are some of the larger social forces and political influences that have driven a particular pathway of change than I am to...
Well, I understand that, but there has to be a point where you're in the history going, oh, they shouldn't have done that. Oh, that was a mistake.
Well, you know, I really love butter.
Yeah.
And so when I think about the decline in the butter industry in the 1950s, part of me thinks, boy, that was pretty precipitous. It had a big impact on the dairy industry in lots of states. And also, who doesn't want to have a buttery sandwich or butter on their toast instead of margarine? So I guess I sound like an apologist for the dairy industry here, but I certainly see that as a path. We've seen a return to butter in recent times, but I think that that was kind of a sad move away from that full fat food.
So when we think of the case of milk and certainly all of the problems that farmers have now, and with pricing and so forth, I guess I was thinking about this while I was reading the book. Is there a point where we ever got this right?
Yeah, that's also a good question. I guess over time, farmers' influence on the policy questions has diminished, as in part their numbers have gone down. And so there's a way in which in the 1920s and 30s, although the solutions that they promoted in some ways set us up for some of the challenges that we face today, there's a way in which farmers were able, both through their political activism, but also through some of their influence during that time, to press legislators to act more on their behalf than they are today. And so by the 1950s, as their numbers decline and as the requirements for producing milk definitely become more and more capital intensive, with specialization of agriculture as well, a lot of those farmers that had been able to get by in the dairy industry in the 1920s and 30s either decide to move out of the agricultural sector entirely or to switch to different products. So their political influence has declined over the course of the 20th century. So I guess there are some of the solutions that were advocated and promoted in the 1920s when farmers had more political influence were at least beneficial for that particular point in time. Are they the right solutions for today? Probably not. Mm. But they were appropriate to some of them were appropriate to that time and place.
You look at different sort of these central tiers, if you will, of milk, whether it be butter, as you mentioned, and ice cream, and the byproducts of milk, uh-huh. as well as milk itself.
Uh-huh.
And there is that a similar, are there commonalities between those as far as how they've been treated by industry and farmers, or as you indicated with the your butter concerns, that they're not, you know, that some go through easier than others for market forces.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that milk is different than some other commodities is because it can be made into so many different things, right? And at the turn of the 20th century, and even into the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, there was a pretty significant difference between the farmers who sold milk to be manufactured into foods like butter or cheese or ice cream and those that were producing for the fluid milk market, where purity was of utmost concern. Many of them were able to produce butter for creameries or cheese factories that were more distant from urban centers, and so they came under different kinds of regulations. And for them, dairy farming was one of many income streams into the farm. It wasn't the only thing that they did. They might have also had hogs and beef cattle and chickens on their farm. So certainly milk's the number of dairy farmers has decreased, but a lot of those farmers that were involved in the manufactured milk industries, like butter or ice cream before World War II were only in part dairy farmers. They were also producing lots of other animal and grain products for market. And so you're right that they all ended up contributing to the dairy market more generally and benefited from some of the same marketing strategies. But what their farms looked like was really quite different. And I'm interested in the path between, relationship between farm and market. Mm. And so I had to include those chapters on other kinds of dairy products because so many of the people that were producing dairy products for market were producing for that manufactured milk market and not for the fluid milk market.
I had no idea that wood glue was made out of milk.
There are some, some of the byproducts of milk go into glue. Yeah, and other crazy things like plastics and paints that coated airplane wings, all kinds of different things were made from milk proteins or from other component parts of milk. And that was one of the ways in which dairy producers hope to get their product to a even wider sector of consumers. So you may be consuming milk even if you don't buy the gallon or get the milk delivered to your doorstep in other smaller forms.
When you, as you said, you're most concerned about how milk gets to us. I mean, that's what you've been looking at of the history. Mm-hmm. So where are we now? Are we at a bump in the road, or are we at a point where we're probably at a stalling point, or are we very much at a crossroads, do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of questions that will really come to bear on the future of where dairy production goes. One has to do with concerns about climate and energy, and water. These sort of natural resources that are very much a part of the ways in which cattle are handled and ways in which the milk gets to us. And another important issue that will have a role here is concerns about labor. How is the labor for farms going to be obtained? And so questions about immigration status is very much a part of the contemporary dairy industry. So although we often think about food as one and agriculture as one sector, these larger concerns about climate, about environment, about labor are very much going to impact and have an effect on where the dairy industry goes in the future.
It's impossible to read this book and not think that the cow is one neat animal.
I'm glad that came across. I hoped to put cows into our histories of milk more explicitly, and also to put a larger role for farm families who, you know, in a lot of the contemporary food writing has focused on the omnivore's dilemma,
right,
on the eater's perspective. But I also wanted readers to get a sense of some of the really perplexing questions and difficult choices that farm families face across the 20th century. So we get a better sense for how we came to some of the changes and technologies that today we look at with quizzical eyes and think, who ever thought that was a good idea? Well, sometimes getting a better sense of the history gives us a sense of some of the really real concerns that drove us to make decisions that put into play things that today we think, boy, that wasn't so good.
Important context.
Yeah.
Kendra Smith Howard is assistant professor of history at the University at Albany. Her new book is Pure and Modern Milk and Environmental History Since 1900. The book is published by Oxford University Press. Kendra, thank you so much for being with us. Great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
A delight. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.